Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to Cult Talk with Aaron Martin, a conversation, not an investigation. Cult Talk is a podcast that explores the realities of cult life, how they operate, who joins them, why people stay, and how some members eventually find their way out. Season one of Cult Talk will focus on a little-known cult called the KOBU, which stands for the Church of Bible Understanding, led by Stuart Trail. In part two of my interview with James LaRue, we talk about several factors that contributed to him leaving the KOBU. James traces his journey out of KOBU, Stuart's motivations in trying to repent, as he saw it, and try to keep members there, and what life was like after KOBU for James and what it's like today. As a reminder, at the time of this interview, Stuart Trail, the leader of KOBU, was still alive. So if you hear us referring to him in the present tense, it's because we recorded this just before he passed away in October. Here's part two of my interview with author and ex-KOBU member James LaRue.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And it's interesting because you had heard other people on the outside, people, quote, of the world, as KOBU members would call them, maybe accuse you of being in a cult or talk about the KOBU like a cult here and there. And that would that give you like a zing? Like, ooh, is it? Or would it make you immediately defensive?
Oh, I'd be on the defensive because they're, in effect, you're a cult member. You're a weird cult member. You're standing on the corner with you know, glassy eyes, and you're trying to sell flowers, you know, like the Moonies, you know, and it's like, we're thinking rational people. We're not crazy. Like, you know, and every cult thinks that all the other groups are cults, you know.
I think you explained it very astutely in your book when you said, you know, if you're trying to get someone out of a cult, it's probably best not to tell them you're in a cult.
Oh, no. Because, you know? Yes,
that's
right.
That's the worst thing you can
say.
They're
going to go on the defensive.
Right. Yeah, so. we can't be like, hey, you're in a cult, get out of the cult. And these, you know, that cult programmer you were talking about who was so, you know, was like was basically locking that kid up. His parents wanted
him
saved. That is never going to work.
It's not going to work.
You know, what worked for you is coming to your own conclusion, but it seemed like you had some resources too. Like you had family members who you could talk to and visit every once in a while. You had some ex-members who you started to trust.
That's right.
You know, and you had a place to live ultimately because those ex-members took you in and they could understand your experience when you left. Do you think all of that conspired to give you the support you needed, or could you have just left with a bag and a hotel room? Or do you think you needed
all those things?
Okay.
No, I think I needed all those things. I do know people who did just leave with a bag over their shoulder and maybe stay in the YMCA or something. Maybe I was a little bit afraid to do that. Where am I going to go? Live in a men's shelter? Or, you know, I really didn't want to do that. And it's good to have people you can go live with. I mean, I was also economically bound in Kobu. I didn't really, I maybe had a bank account, a few hundred dollars in it. It's not like I had a separate job or living arrangements outside of Kobu and I was just visiting it. So it was good to be able to move somewhere. I mean, I started working outside of the cult right away, but to not have to, like, how am I going to pay for an apartment? How can I put a down payment on an apartment? You know, you can't leave because you're an economic prisoner as well.
You're a spiritual, social, economic, physical
and
prisoner,
whatever else,
everything
physical,
else.
All those things, yes.
That leads into the idea of this total institution model. Can you explain what that is and how the Kobu fits within that? Because that really is why you're stuck there.
All right, to explain that in a few words, most people, your life is divided up into separate areas. You have your family life, you have a job, you know, unless perhaps you're self-employed or whatever, but you work outside the home, you may have an employer, and then you have your social life. You might belong to different clubs or meetups or whatever you do that's not your job and not your home life. And they're separate. So if you mess up in one area, and maybe you have a religious life too, you go to a church or whatever you believe in, you go to wherever that those people meet. So these are separate areas. So for instance, if I was in church and I said to the pastor, you know, I don't really believe what you're saying, or I don't even believe in this Christianity anymore. Right. I go to work on Monday morning, you know, I'm not going to find out that I'm being fired. See, because they're separate spheres of life. And, or when I come home at the end of the church service, my apartment door is padlocked. I'm being evicted. You know, that's hard to do to somebody, you know, or you can get fired from your job. It's not a church job. And you can still go to church on Sunday or talk to your friends after work, and they're going to support you. These areas are separate. So you can't really control a person. You can really do poorly in another, and the people in the other areas in your life are still there for you. But in Kobu, all of that's under one roof.
Right.
So if I mess up, I'm working in the church business, I was on a job and I didn't perform correctly, I don't know, the customer complained on Sunday in quote church, which is really a meeting, you know, we're going to talk to everybody. Let's review how the business is doing. Who do we need to talk to? We need to talk to Jim LaRue. He did this, the customer. So that you're getting this at church. So it's not like you can find solace in your religious faith on Sunday when you go to church. You know, things are going badly in your job, but you have these other areas in your life where you can refresh yourself. But in Kobu, it's all the same. And these are the people you live with as well. And if you want to call it socializing, I don't know if you can say you socialize in Kobu. You know, they got you on all points.
They do.
You can't go anywhere. You're completely surrounded.
You're completely surrounded.
You're in a hermetically sealed environment. Everything's under one roof. And I got that concept from, I think it was coined by a sociologist called Irvin Goffman.
Yes.
And he studied institutions, mental institutions, the military, especially basic training in the military. It's not to knock the military, but at least in basic training, you know, they remove your identity, give you a different name, put you in a uniform. You can't leave the place. They put you through intense and you're getting yelled at all the time. And this is to give you, you know, it's to mold a certain character in you. So for at least that time, you know, you can't go visit your family. That's a total institution. And also mental institutions where, you know, if you're in that institution, you must be the kind of person who deserves to be here. And you know, people sometimes don't get treated well in places like that. And I suppose also in communist countries as well, you know, but anyway, these are total institutions.
Yeah. A prison.
And that opened
a parallel.
My eyes. Yes.
You know, and you were in a prison of sorts. Mm-hmm. And people will ask the question, you know, they will, and they probably have. Well, why not just walk out because you weren't actually in a prison?
Right. The bar, there were no bars, no locks on the doors, at least not on the inside. I mean, lock the house at night or whatever, but it's inside. I mean, the thing to say, though, a lot of people did leave.
Right.
So, you know, when you ask that question, why didn't you leave? Well, a lot of people did. And there's a great divide between those who leave and those who stay. After the people leave, you don't hear about them anymore and they're not discussed. So it's like
the things you do hear are bad, right?
Are bad. They left and they, you know, well, if someone, things happen are going good for somebody, that story is not going to get repeated inside the cult. But if somebody ended up in jail, we're going to hear about that.
Right.
Hear about so-and-so, they left, they're in jail now.
Their life has fallen apart. Let's talk about it. Yeah. That's, I think that's a really classic kind of manipulation when you only talk about those who left their bad scenarios happening.
The bad scenarios happen.
You never hear about the success stories. You never want to hear from ex-members who are thriving and who have, you know, developed good family, spiritual work lives outside of a group like that. Never.
Right. And it's difficult for those people to come and talk to everyone because some of the group members did. They come back and try and they get assaulted, not physically, but verbally assaulted. So, you know, it's like one of the shootouts in a Western, you know, you're just going to get ganged up on and people yelling at you. And it just turns into a heated debate. So it's not like people are going to sit down and talk. How's your life going? You know, that's a sign if your cult or any group you're in, if your church or any group you're in is a cult or not. If you've left, if you can come back and talk to people and visit. And they're like, oh, how have you been? How's it been since you moved and you've gone to that other church? Oh, my life's going good. Instead of like, you've left our church. You need to come back here. You know, if you're threatened with leaving the group you're in, that's a good sign that it's a cult.
That's a great sign that you're in a cult.
Believing the only true way, you know, or others may know things, but not like we do.
Exactly. When the leader and then the members fall in line with the idea that ours is the only way and everyone else is wrong, that is a huge sign of a cult mentality.
There are subtle twists on that. Ours is not the only way and others do know things, but ours is the only way for you. Especially now that you know the things that you've learned here, you can't go back to not knowing them. Right. So there's plausible deniability. You know, maybe the idea of people outside of a cult trying to understand it, they think it's just there's people saying this is the only way. And if you leave it, you know, it's a little more subtle than that. Yes, what comes down to that is what they're really saying when pushed. No, we are not the only place you can be. But, you know, for you, certain conditions apply.
I want to talk about Stuart's motivations. And this is, of course, just our opinions. You have a much more informed opinion than I do.
All right.
What do you think the true motivations for starting and continuing Kobu over all of these years really were? And did they change? I mean, I think, is it money at the heart of it? Is it power? Was it sex? Because he ultimately took, you know, he started really stepping out with these Gale helpers of his wife. Mm-hmm. He admitted a little bit of indiscretions about, but the reports over the years that I've read are that he truly was, you know, preying on these girls who lived in his house. What was it? Was it just wanting to have the power? Was that at the root? Tell me what you think.
Well, okay. When you ask it like that, it might seem that he was like, you know, I'm going to start a cult because I want money, women, and power. Maybe not. I mean, if you just listen to his own story, you could even say there's some validity. I mean, you can see, there's always truth to what people say, even manipulators, because they're manipulating the truth. He said he was researching religion and wanted to find out what the best religion was for his kids. I think it was. So he was an atheist and he started a survey and he decided that Christianity was the best, especially because there are miracles, you know, in the Bible. He decided that Jesus' miracles are true. So let's say he started off with that motivation and he started going to Bible studies. It's hard to explain the whole background, but obviously, maybe you know from your mother's stories, a lot of young people meeting together at a church, and he kind of did this takeover. Like, whoever's with me, come with me and we'll start our own thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very, very superficial version of it. And he was a little bit older than all of them. And his mindset is that he knows better. And there's also the story of his brother, Larry, who talked to Mike Montoya. And Larry said that Stuart was always manipulative, even as a kid, deeply manipulative and into power plays. So I guess he does have that personality. So these things kind of came together. And it's almost like saying it's too good not to. You have all these kids following you, looking up to you as a leader. You're all working together and consolidating your money for these fellowship houses. Hey, let's unify this, pool together our resources together. And so we can skim money off the top to buy vehicles. You know, let's organize this. So, hey, you know, I can live off that. You know, there's money in the bank. You know what I mean? He's over time taking control. You know, I'm speculating here. I wasn't there then. You know, what I'm trying to say, did he intentionally go into and saying, I want to start a cult so I have power over people? Probably not. But as he went into this thing, the kind of personality he was, he began, you know, I could do this. In fact, I remember him saying different times, and other people said this, he would say, I could tell you anything, you would believe it, wouldn't you?
He would tell you that outright?
Yes. I remember it a few times and others saying that. And in other words, he's aware, like, you know, you're all willing to give me this trust, so I'm going to take advantage of it. Now, you wouldn't say that part, but from what people have said about his growing up and everything, he was this kind of a person. So when being able to be in the position of that power, naturally, he took it. That's how he operated. You know, that it was his nature to be this way.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, motivations do change over the years. And I don't think I don't think necessarily anyone goes into something like this with a and with an entire plan. You know, in the other cults I've researched, the leader is the leader. You know, they don't change all that much, but they change, their motivations can shift, but they all seem to be based on power and a sense of needing to be worshiped and followed unequivocally. No questions asked.
Yes.
Yeah. And that seems to be Stuart. And it did turn into, you know, playing people against one another. He would even really turn on the women, but then secretly, you know, be after the women himself. I mean, you talked in your book about him preaching about this nature of Eve with the women, you know, being evil and needing to be dominated. And then he would turn the brothers against the sisters. But he himself wanted these young girls to think that he was the only man worthy.
Only one who could understand them and who really cared about them.
Right.
Yeah, that was a big power play. You know, these brothers, either they don't care or they're incapable of caring. If you ever did get married to one of them, your life would be miserable. And but I understand you. And, you know, it's, you know, only Stuart understands you. I don't think he would quite come out and say that, but you got it. When you followed the things he set out to their logical conclusions, he would set up arrangements so that these women could live with him. And he would call them Gale Huppers, you're here to help my wife with her projects. She's got so many projects, she needs help, right? So there'd be 10 or 20, 30 women who could come and live with Stuart and Gale in their house. And of course, they would compete for places there. And there'd always be the ones who were kicked out and sent back to the bad living arrangements. So that would keep them on their toes. So he would play them against one another.
Right. And it was like he was building a harem of women who were dependent upon him.
No other word for it. Harem. Yes.
Yeah. That's
yes.
a harem.
Building a harem of women. Yes.
You know, and I think
dependent on him.
That's classic cult leader mentality, too.
It is.
I mean, you see that over and over and over again.
Everywhere. When you're in all the cults.
All of them.
Yes.
The guy at the top ends up building a harem, period. End of story. And Stuart was no different. Now, you mentioned actually him moving into the boys' dormitory quarters. And so they built kind of this whole compound living situation for he and Gale and all the Gale helpers. And he wanted a secret staircase or something built. What was that all about? To access the women's quarters?
Okay. Well, let me tell you the background on it. Stuart, before that, was living in a large house and property in Princeton that he bought. Again, it was in the church's name. And the Gale helpers lived there. So before this whole thing broke about him needing to repent and start over, the church, him, really were already looking into this. It was a city block in Philadelphia, and it was an old boys' home. So it had dormitories and, you know, grounds, lawns and everything. You know, it was a facility. You wanted to use that for Kobu's operation, run the donation programs out of that, you know, a lot of storage space in there. So while that was going on, you know, he had moved there with Gale and the Gale helpers, and they took one of the dormitories, and one level was for Stuart and Gale, and the other level, I don't know how many rooms are in there, was for the Gale helpers. And I don't have that firsthand, but from someone else who left, one of the older, they call them older live out married brothers. And there's all these different categories, right?
Right.
Told me, and there's one of the brothers there where Stuart confessed on the side to the older live out married brothers, more details of what he had done with at least one of the Gale helpers, which he didn't tell those of us who lived in, you know, at all. So this person,
he had an indiscretion with one of the Gale helpers, and he,
right.
he
whatever
underplayed
this
it.
May be. Mm-hmm. He underplayed it, but he didn't mention any indiscretions at the meetings to us who lived in. Mm-hmm. So that's manipulation of information as well. But again, this is all leading up to the secret staircase. But he also just to walk down the hallway and walk into the rooms, too. I know I was talking to one of the women who was there. He would just walk in. You know, they're all sleeping in their dormitory style, and he'd walk in. So he obviously very familiar with walking in into the rooms and everything.
He just had free access to all of the young women.
Free access one way or another.
So he was having access to the women. You know, he just could freely do whatever he wanted, basically. And it was all in secret, it sounds like.
Very good at keeping it secret. But the thing is, the women would keep it secret, too. And they still do now.
I know. I don't see many reports of women coming out and saying, this is what happened to me.
Not at all, really.
I wonder if now in this Me Too and Time's Up movement, if more women will come forward, or if it's so, you know, this Kobu mentality is still so ingrained in them, the shame, or they brought it on themselves, or Stewart's old manipulation. I would just, not that I want a woman to go through the torture of going public and then getting accused of things, but I would love to see more of the truth come out about what Stewart did.
Well, it should come out. I mean, it should come out. What harm would it do? Some of the things I think, too, on one hand, they're Stewart's close circle, so they either knew of that, him doing whatever it was with others, and or took part in it themselves. They were involved personally with Stewart in that way, or knew of it. So they're aiding and abetting. Now, in order to talk about it, they're going to have to talk about what they did too, whether personally or they knew it was going on. And that's self-incriminating.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so that's one very potential reason. The other one too is they don't want to hurt the people who are still in it. I've heard this so many times. When you try to get someone in Kobu to talk to a reporter or whatever, look, I don't want to, there are people who are still in the group, and I don't want to hurt them. And I don't even know how valid that is. I've talked to two people who said that. One was during the beginning of All Good Things, where they were undercutting the other antique dealers in the city. A reporter wanted to talk to the ex-treasurer of the group, we were renting a house at the time, several of us ex-members. He didn't want to talk to them because there's still people in the group he didn't want to hurt.
Right.
Also the suspicion, you know, the reporters are malicious 100%, which is not true. They do want sensational details. During the Haiti thing, someone, I don't remember his name, is rather well known, talked to me on the phone. And he said, look, I don't want to know about you and what happened to you. I want to know details on Haiti. So he was just, he didn't quite say it like that.
Wow.
So in other words, they're not always wanting to tell the story. But in other words, but some reporters, they really look, reading books by reporters helped me when I was still in the group, and I coming to understand not everyone is malicious when talking about the group you're in.
Yeah.
And then recently too, I mean, someone wanted to interview me and they wanted to talk to others who were in the group, and I contacted someone and I said, a reporter would like to talk to you. And he went into the song, I don't trust it. I don't want to speak to the world about these things. What are their motivations? And I was like, look, just going to interview people who are in Kobu. You can talk, and it's just no go. It wasn't going to happen. But I understand the mindset.
Yeah, that's kind of heartening for me to hear and disheartening at the same time, because I thought I've really been struggling getting ex-members to talk to me. And as my listeners
said,
know,
you only had two.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't even know if they're going to be on board. We'll see. Right. I mean, they're really hesitant, and I understand it. My own mother wouldn't talk for a year. I started this podcast almost a year ago, and I was talking about Kobu at the very beginning of it, just lightly, you know, I didn't do a whole series or anything, but she said, no. And none of my friends who are kids of parents who left will speak about it to me. I thought that they would, you know, because really the kids can speak more freely because we didn't join or leave.
A little bit better. Yes. When I was in Kobu, I read a book called Fair, Clear, and Terrible, and it was written by someone like you, kids.
There you go.
The members and the parents would get together and talk about the group they're in.
Absolutely.
And she got interested in it, and she wanted to research it, and that book helped me while in a cult, because that cult was just like Kobu.
Exactly.
And 100 years ago.
But, you know, I think it's difficult for people to even call the Kobu a cult, who especially...
maybe not use that word.
Yeah,
it was a fringe group or a highly controlling, high demand religious group. You can avoid the word.
Yeah, the word cult really
sets people off. It's a volatile word.
It's a very volatile word. It's like using the word alcoholic or addiction as opposed to drinking problem. I mean, people just really get wrapped up in the label, and it's like, well, it's a form of a group that takes a turn in these whatever 100 ways. And so if Kobu fits that, and I think it's hard to personally say I was in a cult. A lot of the awful things that happen aren't a huge fire or murder.
They're not.
Rape after rape. They're mm-hmm. mind control. They're taking away years of your life.
Yes.
Making you question your own sanity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a psychological torture. And I actually wonder that about you. You know, do you hold resentment for losing those years of your life? Are you in some small way grateful that you've learned something other people haven't, or was it too high of a price to pay? I mean, what are your feelings on that? How do you work
through
that?
That's a good question. I never find myself being angry about it. Now, sometimes I wonder why I don't.
That's good.
You know, like Stewart, he did this. He took, you know, right. I only got angry a little bit after Stewart made his big confession. This is like 1989. 3 months later, I got, what? This guy's been lying to me. But that was the only time I really ever got that way. You know, and it's good. I sometimes wonder why I didn't, or even now I'm not like that. I know some people, others are though.
Yeah.
You know, there's a range of reactions. I mean, mine isn't the one size fits all. There are others, you know, they're grateful for what they learned, and there are others who they're angry, you know? So there's a range of reactions.
Do you feel like you were able to start, I mean, you're married now. Do you feel like you were able to start your relationships anew, or do you feel like that mentality of the cult carried over into preventing you from starting relationships? Like it, you know, that's a huge period of your mm-hmm. life. How did right. you, were you like basically a young adult mindset when you got out, or
yeah,
how did it
in
work
a way,
for you?
Yes. Yeah. So it's like a 36 year old, 25 year old or something. I must've right. grown a few years while I was in there, but there are other areas where I didn't progress. So, you know, getting back into gear, you know, you're getting into the subject, the cult recovery now.
Yes.
Like transitioning back into, well, a very discouraging line. After I left, I read in a book about cults, is reading a book on recovery about cults, and one of the lines of the book said, it may take some cult members as many years as they've been in the cult to recover from the cult after leaving it. I was like, 14 years.
But, oh my God, no.
It can take you time to recover. It's because you've been thinking a certain way, you're used to dealing with the world in a certain way. Of course, there's going to take time to recover. And you've given, you know, you've gone, lived a certain way for so many years. I mean, there is recovery.
There is recovery. So let's end on a hopeful note. What would you tell people who are in a group that feels very oppressive and isolating and they don't see a way out? How did you recover, or what hope can you give them? What tools can they use that worked for you?
Okay. Well, one thing, you know, if you fear leaving, that recovery would be difficult and painful, think about what staying is going to do. You know, mm-hmm. if you stay another 5 years, another 10 years, I mean, it's going to get painful one way or another. And yes, it will be difficult. It helps to have a network. You know, the ex-members understand you. And the thing is, the ex-members have been kind of vilified. If you're in the group, the people who left are of the devil, or they're against us. And that can't be true about all the ex-members. You know, many of them are just like you. They're in a position you were in, and they were thinking of leaving, and they did. And maybe they didn't all leave under good circumstances. But they're the ones, you know, they understand. They're not likely to say, yeah, you were in a cult. How could you have been in a cult for, you know, because they've gone through it. And it's good to reconnect with that network and not to feel that these people are somehow the enemy, and you're not, even though you're leaving, but you're not like, you know, you're just another one of them. Yep. And they realized it before you did.
They've just gone before you in the same journey.
They've gone before you. They realize the same things, maybe not in the way you did. I mean, different people leave for different reasons. But it's good to try to find some of those people and talk to them.
Yeah, I agree. Because they're not mm-hmm. going to be judgmental of
exactly
why did you stay? Why didn't you? Mm-hmm. They're going to say, yeah, I get it.
They understand, you know, why you did.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that afterwards it is beneficial to then keep talking to people, keep that community going, or do you feel like separating from that is more important, or is there some combination that has worked for you?
There's a combination. I mean, I pretty much stayed mostly in contact with ex-COBU people. First of all, there are a lot of them, you know, for my first jobs, living arrangements. But of course, you want to branch out, meet other people. I mean, it's good to meet other people. And, you know, you need to deal with other people who are not in the same mindset. You're going to learn to have to navigate a more complicated world. I mean, the cult world is complicated in its own way, but it's also simplified in other ways.
Yeah, that's true.
It's familiar. You know what to expect, the things you're supposed to say and not say. And a lot of that's very clear. And getting out, it's like, you know, you're kind of learning new ropes. But it's worth it. It's better than staying, really.
Yeah, it is.
Staying, you hope your group's going to get better. It's getting better. So, you know, not necessarily.
Yeah, you don't have to ride the elevator all the way to the basement. Like yeah, they say good. In some recovery groups, you know, you can get off at any floor you want
you get
to.
Off. Right.
You don't have to keep going down.
You have to go down with the ship.
Exactly. Do you find that you get a certain kind of reaction from people who have never experienced a cult or have never mm-hmm. known anyone who have been in a cult-like group when you share your story? Or do you keep your story private from those people?
Mostly private. I mean, when I do say it, you know, they're going to be like, how could you have been?
Right, exactly.
You know, my wife's parents are like, you know, how could you marry a guy? There must be something really wrong with him. You know, it's like the red flag, you know, there must be, you know, it could only be because there's something really wrong with him, that he was susceptible. And not only that, stayed for so long.
Right.
I mean, it's not, I mean, just to blatantly tell someone that you were in a cult, people's idea of what a cult is, you know, again, you might say I was in a very demanding religious group and it really weren't, you know, or they thought they were the exclusive ones and they weren't. And then you might hear a little more. I hear you. I kind of, you know, I used to visit some place. They thought you might get a little more understanding out of that if you avoid saying I was in a cult, because people think you're just, you were a robot.
Exactly. Well, that word is like so that. Incendiary. Yeah. It's hard to say it and move on from there with a conversation. Right. It's like the conversation stops at cult.
Right. You're implying I'm on a job interview. So what did you do? Well, I was in a cult and I worked for the cult. And
oh my God. You know,
that's probably not going to go good either. I've told people that, you know, I worked for a business that was, you know, kind of fun. You know, it was owned by the church owned business, and people just kind of, all right, you know, I mean, there are ways to talk about things.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that you wrote these books and that you're willing to talk about it, you know, in the context of a deeper look and not just make it a sensational story, because that's what I'm trying to do. I really feel like that was my parents' experience too. And I experienced that, of course, as the next generation. When I say to people, oh, well, I was born in a cult, it's that's a stop right there statement
right
as
there.
Well.
So you know what you know the feeling, right?
And it's like they want to know if I went through ritual satanic abuse, it's all the horrible things that come to mind. And I'm like, well, we all lived in like pretty crappy apartments. And I remember like staying up all night in sleeping bags at these meetings. Like, I don't remember a whole lot of really dramatic stuff,
right.
But it's a hard place to start a conversation when you say, I was in a cult or I was born in a cult. So I appreciate this conversation that you were willing to have with me today.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you about it.
Yeah. And can you tell people where to find you and where to find your books, which are fabulous?
On Amazon, there's the book Captive Congregation. If you type that title in, it should come up. There's another one I wrote called Letters from the Cult. I think there's another one with the same. No, it's called The Tangled Web.
Yes.
The subtitle is Letters from the Cult. You know, that there are probably several books with that same title. And that's more correspondence. Most of it were letters to my mother who lived out, but other people, including to some cult researchers when I was still in. And what that book is written at the time I was still in the group. And the purpose of writing all that was to explain to people outside the group how strange it was or what it was like to be here. So, I mean, there's some value to that. Social media, I mean, Facebook, there's a ex-Kobu cult members page. I'm not running that or anything, but I can provide more on that.
Yeah, I'll put that all in the
later.
Show notes. So we can,
right.
I'll put all the links in the show notes to your books, to that ex-members Kobu group. That's really the one I was thinking of. That is a place where people can go who have been in Kobu, or maybe they've had family members in it, and they can talk to other people. And when you spoke of, you know, speaking to ex-members or that the help that can provide you, I think social media is a great way to do that now. So we'll link that up.
Right.
For sure.
Good. You can connect to people a lot easier now.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, on another note, you paint now. You're an artist.
I do.
So
yes.
Do you have a website anywhere that people can look at your art that we can?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's JamesLarueIllustrations.com.
James, I really appreciate this. Do you have anything else that was left unsaid that we didn't touch on? I mean, we could talk for like 16 hours.
Yeah, there's a lot left unsaid. Yes.
Yeah, but anything that you think is important that we just didn't hit today?
Well, I can't think of anything offhand off the top of my head. I mean, there are a lot more things to go into. And maybe also if listeners are starting to ask questions, you know, what are the concerns of people who want to know?
Yeah.
Maybe it could address coming from that as well.
Yeah.
If certain issues start coming up, you know, what about this or what do I do? You know, maybe take it from there and find out what people would like to know about.
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea. And I'll have my email in the show notes as well. And listeners, you can email me at the podcast. And if you have questions for James or about the Kobu in general, you can ask them. And James, if you'd be willing to maybe come back on after we get some listener input and answer some of those questions, I would really appreciate
that. I could do that.
Okay.
That would be really good.
All right.
Okay.
That sounds amazing.
All right, Aaron.
Aaron.
We'll pause here for now, but join us for the continuing story on the next episode of Cult Talk. Also, join the listener conversation over on the Cult Talk with Aaron Martin Facebook page. Follow at Cult Talk on Twitter and Instagram, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast from any platform and leave us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. Cult Talk is written and hosted by me, Aaron Martin, and produced by Dan McInerney. See the show notes attached to this episode for all links to resources and social media associated with Cult Talk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.